Good evening and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. My name is Paul Clark, your chair for the presentation today on the topic, Is Armed Conflict with China Avoidable? With Professor Christopher Toomey from the Naval Postgraduate School in Monterey. I'd like to read you a little bit about Professor Toomey. He's an associate professor at the Naval Postgraduate School in Monterey, as I mentioned, and his research centers on security issues, China foreign policy, and East Asian security, a very broad topic. Professor Toomey is the former director of the Center for Contemporary Conflict at the Naval Postgraduate School, and he has a book entitled The Military Lens, Doctrinal Differences and Deterrence Failure in Sino-American Relations, that was published by Cornell Press recently. Here's the book. It's actually for sale outside, and Dr. Toomey would be glad to sign it for you if you choose to buy it. So why are we bringing this topic to the members of the club? Well, it's a momentous time for China. In recent years, it passed Japan as the second largest economy in the world, held a very successful Olympics, celebrated the 20th anniversary of its founding. It's going through a leadership change next year. And all this is very important to the American observer and American interests. Because China poses many challenges to the U.S. and many opportunities. Well, there's a lot more to say about that topic, but let's get the professional, Professor Toomey. Please help me welcome Professor Christopher Toomey.
Thanks very much, Paul, and thank you all for coming. I appreciate the opportunity to come back to the Commonwealth Club and speak to you all today. By posing the question, is armed conflict with China avoidable? It's obviously intentionally a little bit provocative, but it's suggesting two things. One, that it's a significant possibility that we need to worry about, that we need to be concerned that indeed we might get into an intense military conflict with a nuclear power adversary, something that we really haven't had to worry about for the previous 20 years, but also that it's avoidable, that through our own behavior we can adjust, manipulate the likelihood of that outcome coming to pass. And so I want to talk about both of those. I've come to that conclusion, to those twin conclusions, somewhat gradually. And on the one hand, I disagree with what is widely held among some academics, and I think a lot of business people who focus on the conclusions, the optimistic conclusions that one might draw from the very high levels of economic exchange between the two, and the context in which the economic relationship is developed, right, which is a set of institutions, WTO, other trade and finance institutions, that were developed by the United States, and China has risen within them, and that suggests a degree of conformity between the two worldviews. While I'm cognizant of those very positive influences, I think they're insufficient to drive outcomes. But on the other hand, I think there's a structural view that you also hear that focuses on hegemonic transitions, the so-called academic theory that looks at the relative increase in war in a context of a hegemonic transition. And I think that draws one's attention to structural variables that are beyond the ability of any individual administration or individual policymakers to manipulate. And so in some sense, it removes the responsibility for actions. And I think, you know, the conclusions I come to are somewhat different. They're much more micro level, that focus on some of the dynamics that are driving decision making in China, which is what I'll focus most of my attention on today. But in the United States, as well. Those are my conclusions, and that's kind of how I came to them. I should say at this point that they're not the Department of the Navy's conclusions, the Department of Defense's conclusions. Unfortunately, they should be, but they're not. And I'll express my opinions and mine alone today. I think there's one common view about China that pictures China as a a long-term strategist, drawing on Sun Tzu and sort of the strategic culture of thousands of years of international activity in the East Asian system, a patient strategy to develop a predominant role in a region that gradually puts the pieces into the position that benefits China the most on the geostrategic playing board that China finds itself. And I think those of you who've spent time looking at China know the Ta Guang Yang Hui phrasing that came out of Deng Xiaoping that refers to, you know, maintaining a low profile, hiding one's capabilities perhaps, and biding one's time. And the idea here is that this was strategic guidance given by Deng to avoid taking too much of a leadership role in the early decades of China's rise, but that there is an end point, that there is an overarching template for Chinese actions that should be guiding the foreign policy makers in China. And this emphasis on a real patience to achieve long-term ends is emphasized a lot in some Chinese historic writings, and I think then in a lot of the way many Westerners talk about China. So I think that's one view about what drives Chinese foreign policy, that it's implementation of a long thought out plan to regain its position that it had in the Qing Dynasty or perhaps earlier. Another, though, comes from a very different dialogue in Chinese policymaking circles. If you look back over the last 35 years, the most important policy initiative has not been a foreign policy initiative. It has been the economic reforms. And when Chinese leaders, Chinese scholars talk about those economic reforms, an alternate phrase comes to mind, and it's 摸着石头过河. It's to cross the river by feeling for stones, that you don't have the exact pathway mapped out. You take a step forward, you look around for where the next stone is available for your footing, and then you move in that direction. And the idea here is, in the economic reform area, China hasn't had the long-term plan mapped out. That's been very clear in the way that the Chinese leadership has undergone the economic reforms, the market reforms that were begun in 1978. And so I think when we think about Chinese foreign policy, sometimes we lapse into the strategic culture arguments when we know in the other area that has received the predominant amount of attention within the Chinese society, that hasn't driven policymaking. Instead, it's been piecemeal, one step at a time. And I think the application of that to the foreign side, the foreign policy side, would emphasize a much more reactive set of policies that have been chosen by the Chinese leadership. And so I want to talk about, you know, while there certainly are some long-term aspirations for Chinese foreign policy, that a lot of what's going on is very reactive in nature in China's foreign and security policy. That doesn't necessarily lead to very optimistic conclusions. I end up being rather pessimistic about Sino-American relations, notwithstanding the very positive economic relationship that I mentioned at the outset. But it's not because I think China has a roadmap towards a future that has the U.S. out of Asia, but it's instead some of this grasping for stones as it moves forward in its development, in the rise of China in Asia, potentially causes some real problems. So let me turn to a couple of specific issue areas. I want to walk through a brief discussion of the South China Sea, the China-Japan relationship, North Korea relationship, and then finally Taiwan, the most sensitive, and just talk about the way in which some of Chinese policy in each of those areas has been rather reactive. First, on the South China Sea, 2010 was a bad year in a lot of different areas of Chinese foreign policy. South China Sea perhaps sits at the forefront of that. This was the area that had been the most prominent success story of China's 2000s, late 1990s and through the mid-2000s foreign policy, the good neighbor foreign policy, the new security concept, that led to some fairly positive relations in the region. But in 2010 and perhaps a little bit the 2 years prior, things started heading in the other way. And maybe just two indicators of that. One was the core interest spat of 2010. China has traditionally not used the term vital national security interest in the same way that the United States does, but instead, at least in the last 5 years, has referred to some core interests. Those traditionally include Xinjiang and Tibet, two parts of China that are internationally recognized as within Chinese border and falling under Chinese sovereignty. And then third, Taiwan, which is much more contestable, but most countries have a one China policy that acknowledges that that's at least a contentious issue. In 2010, Dai Bingguo, who is the leading foreign policy government representative, not the foreign minister, but sitting above the foreign minister, apparently in a conversation with Secretary Clinton, also added the South China Sea, mentioned it as another core interest. And so this was taken in American press and then within the region as an expansion of Chinese core interest. China has grown more powerful over the last 30 years, and lo and behold, we see them moving the pieces on the go-playing board into position and expanding its definition of what its core interests are. What you see up here on the map, for those of you who aren't familiar with it, are Chinese territorial claims. The dotted line there, the long looping cow's tongue, as it's sometimes referred to in Chinese, or the Zhoujian Xian, the nine dashed line as it's represented on Chinese maps, is a Chinese claim that goes back to 1947 and shows up on any map produced in the PRC. But this map had not been used as a grounds for territorial claims in the context of international law under the UN. But again, if you look in the 2009-2010 period, there's another instance where this map, a map using the nine dashed line, was submitted to the UN as part of an official Chinese submission under the UN Convention of the Law of the Sea, UNCLOS. Making explicit that China was claiming a more elevated legal status for that longstanding, to be fair, claim that it had had that reaches right to the borders of Indonesia, Malaysia, and well past Vietnam and Philippines in that region. And so those two incidents, perhaps, in 2009 and 2010 are, to some extent, the high watermark of an assertive Chinese policy, or what's perceived as an assertive Chinese policy. But I think it's important to recognize that there is a broader context within which those exist. First, on the statement that was apparently made to Secretary Clinton, it was made not in a public forum. She reports out that it was said to her, and it was, and more importantly than that, that it was said to her in a private context. Doesn't make it false; it just makes it less amplified. But it wasn't repeated by other Chinese officials, and hasn't found its way into official Chinese declaratory policy in white papers or in the foreign ministry's spokesperson's remarks on the South China Sea. And the spokesperson has commented a number of times, has had opportunities to include the South China Sea as a core interest, and has not done so. So the broader context, maybe that was just a flash in the pan, a once-off statement, either a trial balloon or somebody just getting a little ahead of their speaking points on the Chinese side. In terms of the submission of a map to the UN making these claims, it's important to recognize that 2009 was an important deadline under the UN Convention of the Law of the Sea, whereby all claimants were supposed to submit their territorial baselines from which exclusive economic zones would be drawn. And so that ended up driving a lot of countries to participate in such similar declarations. The Vietnamese and the Philippines both passed laws in 2007 preparing the way for their submission to the UN. The Malaysian Prime Minister visited one of Malaysian-held islands in the Spratlys. The Spratlys are jointly held by six different countries, China, Taiwan, Malaysia, Philippines, Vietnam, Indonesia, and Brunei, in the region. All the countries involved were playing a role in solidifying their claims in order to pave the way for these official submissions that had to go through the UN. And that certainly led to a Chinese reaction. You had polls on the Chinese side expressing strong support for the idea that the South China Sea would be included as a core national interest. 97% of the people responding to a People's Daily, a Renmin Ruibao online poll, said yes, it should be a core interest. But we know that these sorts of polls and this sort of internet activism isn't necessarily the best indicator, and it's certainly not a sign of official Chinese policy. But it certainly, at the same time, drives the need for press coverage in places like the Global Times, a sort of nationalist hothead newspaper in China that amplifies the importance of these sorts of issues. Another important bit of context is since then, China has perhaps shown some signs of returning to the lateral negotiating table. In 2002, it had signed on to the Declaration on Conduct in the South China Sea with the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, with the 10 nations in ASEAN, and that process was reinvigorated last year in 2011, and some sign of China recognizing that it had gone too far, perhaps. Just turn to another maritime area. The border with Japan, where again you have contested islands, in this case the Senkaku Islands, that have sparked the occasional nationalist uprising in the mainland, for instance in 2005 in the wake of some incidents surrounding a Japanese-built lighthouse on the Senkakus. Japan controls the Senkaku, Chinese call the Diaoyutai. In 2010, again a very bad year for China, a Japanese Coast Guard vessel was chasing away a Chinese fishing vessel from the fishing areas surrounding the Senkakus, and the Chinese fishing vessel rammed the you can see a picture of it down below, rammed the Coast Guard vessel, leaving some damage on the Coast Guard vessel. Instead of simply arresting and sending home all the ship's crew, in this case Japan held on to the ship's captain for over 2 weeks, leading again to a very large nationalist protest in the PRC. Not mass movement on the streets, although there were some small protests, but certainly a very active internet critique of the government policy towards Japan and of Japanese behavior in general, leading to demands for reparations by the government, by the PRC government to Japan, demand for compensation, formal demarches. And this is what sparked the rare earth issue coming to the fore in terms of China embargoing rare earths to Japan and perhaps more broadly that is continuing to percolate on today in the Obama administration's decision to move that towards WTO sanction. Again, here the context that one needs to remember is that you have ongoing nationalist tensions between the two that really tie the PRC government's hand in ways that they've been complicit in creating through ramping up nationalism in terms of textbook changes over the last 15 to 20 years, but in ways that give them limited leeway when any given crisis comes about at a particular time. In both of these cases, I think Chinese behavior becomes more assertive, more aggressive, because they have to react to events that are going on either within China or within the region. When you talk about some of the other areas, North Korea policy, It's both a different and a similar story. I think in Sino-American relations, there is a greater difference of national interest over Korea than there are in some of the other areas. The U.S. stake in small island disputes, whether contested by Japan or by the Southeast Asian nations and China, is relatively small. The U.S. stake on the Korean Peninsula is very high. But nevertheless, you see the Korean tail wagging the Sino-American dog, again in 2010 with the Chonan incident, where an international study concludes that the Chonan, a South Korean frigate, was destroyed by North Korean forces, and the Chinese refused to accept that international study and serve as a protector, in some sense, of the North Korean regime in terms of international condemnation on that. Later that year, in the Yongpyeong island shelling issue, again, the Chinese rhetoric emphasizes that there was shelling going in both directions, whereas on the U.S. side and the South Koreans would note that the shelling exercise in South Korea was not aimed at any landmass in North Korea, whereas the North Korean shelling killed four people in South Korea. China, again, ends up being very defensive. When the U.S. and South Korea move to reinvigorate the alliance and engage in exercises, the protests from the PRC are extremely strong. Behind all three of these issues, that is the Korea, South China Sea, and East China Sea with Japan issues, is based on a Chinese conception of exclusive economic zone rights that are considerably more exclusive than most of the rest of the world, that restrict a military role in what is intended to be an economic area that provides for economic resources, but shouldn't constrain too much in the way of military transits or exercises or reconnaissance. And that has really provided a lot of fuel to Chinese protests on some of these areas and given the Chinese side a lot of grounds for amplifying their protests on these issues. Taiwan is, of course, a unique instance because it is a territorial dispute where, in contrast with the small unoccupied islands, you have over 20 million Taiwanese in residence, and they have their own conception of national identity that is increasingly at odds with that of the mainland. But again, here you have a third-party actor that plays a large role in shaping the Sino-American relationship in ways that are out of Beijing's control, also to a large extent out of the United States' control. And I think if you look in the second term of the Bush administration, a lot of effort was expended on restraining the provocations that were coming out of the Chen Shui-bian administration and limiting the damage that that might pose to the region and to the stability of American relationships in the region. But that's put both the United States and China in a very reactive position. And when you talk about arms sales issues that have gone on, whether the 2010 mid-sized arms sale that completed approval of weapons that had initially been approved by the Bush administration, that led to a very sharp response from the Chinese side against the United States, that cut off all mill-to-mill ties for about a year, giving us the silent treatment on as a sign of protest, or the more modest response in 2011. Again, in both cases, China is responding to events that are happening elsewhere and not engaged in a lot of policy initiatives on the Taiwan issue. I mean, if you look at Hu Jintao's or preceding him, Jiang Zemin's initiatives, they were modest in terms of their scope in relative terms. All of these are dangerous because there are some difference of national interests at stake in each of these four areas, to be sure. But I think beyond that, one of my real concerns increasingly is there's a military dynamic that is being fueled by these differences in national interest. What I've put up here on the projector is Washington think tank's assessment of the Chinese access denial and area defense, anti-access and area denial strategy, what's called the A2AD. And the idea here is China has increasingly invested its military capabilities in areas that target U.S. capabilities that might be brought to bear over the Taiwan Strait. In particular, you've got a range of different missile systems, short-range missiles that could be used against Taiwan. Those have been around now for 10 or 15 years. We're used to thinking about them. What's now of more contemporary concern are missiles that might be used to target American carriers that would need to be brought to the region in support of that. This is a sort of military development to provide coercive leverage over Taiwan that I think has been a gradual buildup, although the missile buildup, again, has been a little bit more recent. But it's also supplemented by diesel submarines that are exceptionally quiet and capable against American capabilities, surface-to-air missile systems that mean any American or Taiwanese or Japanese aircraft flying in the area would be at risk far offshore from Taiwanese from PRC airspace. These are steps that China can take, and on the one hand, they wouldn't be unnerving, except that the United States, of course, is going to take steps to respond. This is a study that's calling for air-sea battle, which is now the package of systems that the United States is developing in response to that, which looks at networked integrated attack in depth. And if you think about what that is, that's a sewing together a synergy of American capabilities between the naval and Air Force realms. But attack in depth should give you some pause, right? We're talking about attacking into the interior of China to address these sorts of coercive tactics against Taiwan in ways that are going to be very provocative in the context of a nuclear-armed adversary. Right, we're trying to remedy a conventional balance by responding with some conventional military innovations on our own part, deep strike bombers, our own standoff precision munitions, increased reliance on submarines, the ability to have penetrating stealthy air assets that certainly make a lot of strategic sense, a lot of military or operational sense that you know my students are quick to point out. But there is a political strategic dynamic that goes on that is deeply unnerving. And so, you know, you start to worry about not China's ability to project power beyond the regions in question here. Be happy in Q&A to talk about what I think is a very limited capability that comes about from the Chinese carrier, which is pictured here for the first time caught by satellite at sea just a couple of months ago. But that doesn't pose much of a danger of spiral with the United States and the military assets that we have in the region. That's something that's fairly straightforward for our strategists to think about countering. But the flip side, the missile deployments and the submarine deployments that are in much larger numbers require a much more focused response that is going to involve attacking Chinese territory. That really raises the issue of spirals and security dilemmas, of senses of insecurity created in China that solidify Chinese perceptions that American intentions are aimed to counter China's growth in all facets, not just in military terms. And we know in particular that one form of military dynamic is particularly problematic, and that's one that, as Paul mentioned, I wrote about in my previous book, which is when you have military strategies that are fundamentally different in nature. The Chinese are developing a missile-based strategy and a submarine-based strategy to hold U.S. forces off. The U.S. is responding by penetrating bombers and strike forces that will rely heavily on integrated communications and joint operations. This means that the two sides are thinking about warfare in very different ways, and so that when they want to signal intentions going into a crisis and when they want to assess the balance of power, as a crisis begins to develop and understand how serious the other side is, it's very hard to understand that the language the other side is using to signal. It's not an English-Chinese issue. It's a different doctrinal language. It's a different military language that the two sides use. And so both because there are some fundamental differences in national interest over some of these areas along China's periphery, but also that there are drivers that occur outside of either capital to potentially escalate those conflicts. And then finally, because you have the domestic politics in both sides, and we talked a little bit earlier about the nationalism on the Chinese side, we should remember there will be some domestic politics in the United States. Here's the representation of different budget drawdowns in the wake of previous wars. As we wrap up the two conflicts in the Middle East, my guess is the U.S. military budget will drop even further than is projected here. What that's going to mean is people are bringing out the long knives to protect their piece of the pie in Washington. And much as I, as an employee of the Department of Navy, certainly want to encourage the retention of important national assets like the Naval Postgraduate School, I recognize that that's going to tend to allow people to make worst-case arguments about the utility of particular military capabilities. So we're going to have domestic politics in the United States pushing for different threat assessments and using threat assessments for political purpose as well. And so I think we need to be concerned about that. Let me just end with, you know, one comment that increasingly, on the positive side, there is some grounds for optimism. This is a picture of the American admiral commanding the Combined Task Force 151 engaged in anti-piracy patrols in Somalia, off the Gulf of Aden, far away from any of the areas that we talked about earlier. And I think it's a real positive way for China to consider its role in the international community and a role for its military that will shape the way its military thinks about optimal ways that it needs to develop and invest in training and in forces procurement going forward. And so I think that's an area that might help reduce some of the dangerous spirals about intentions that are being driven by some of the internal military dynamics that come about because of a natural strategic process on both sides to develop capabilities that would be able to defend the differences in national interest in the issue areas that I outlined earlier. So let me pause there. I put a fair amount on the table, and I'd be more than happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Professor Toomey. I'd like to remind our listening audience that this is a program of the Commonwealth Club of California, and you're listening to Professor Christopher Toomey speak on the potential for armed conflict between the U.S. and China. We will now take your questions. Please use the microphone because we are recording the broadcast. Thank you. Who will be first?
Thank you. Your views are very much aligned with former Secretary of Defense Bill Perry, who several years ago opined that he felt that there would be military conflict between Taiwan and mainland China. I wonder if you could expand on that, if you share that view, and what do you think the catalyst might be for that kind of event?
Taiwanese-Chinese relations are now at the best point they have been since 1942-44. During the Chinese Civil War, there was a period when the KMT and the CCP, the two key parties here, got along in order to cooperate by pushing the Japanese out. And since then, things went sour. And under President Ma Ying-jeou in Taiwan, the relation really has really improved substantially. You've got very high levels of trade. You've got a regularization, not a normalization, but a regularization of administrative contact between the government on Taiwan and the government in the PRC. That said, Taiwan continues to want to develop its own military in ways to reduce the threats from the mainland, is enthusiastic to draw the United States into a closer relationship. So there certainly is a deep sense of insecurity on the Taiwanese side. I think the most important reason to be pessimistic, and I'm going to come back to how pessimistic I am on that particular score, but I think the most important reason to be pessimistic is to look at polling numbers that ask in Taiwan, how do you conceive of yourself? What are you? Are you Chinese, Taiwanese, both, or neither? I think nationalism is one of the most powerful forces in human affairs and in international affairs. And that's a question that asks, how strong is your nationalism and what is the nature of that nationalism? And if you look over time, the number of people who identify themselves as primarily Chinese has dropped to single digits, low single digits. The number of people who identified themselves as both has dropped, although still remains a healthy plurality. But the majority now are identify themselves solely as Taiwanese, and that trend line continues to go up. There was a sense under the previous administration, Chen Shui-bian administration in Taiwan, that was promoting a more pro-independent Taiwanese identity, that this was a temporary change that was being affected by the government in power and the textbook changes that it was putting into place and the rhetoric changes that it was using to describe its own identity. But that it has continued in the last 4 years under President Ma Ying-jeou, I think is suggestive that that's tapping into something deeper, that the people who were born in Taiwan after the Civil War era don't feel a connection with the mainland in the same way that their parents' generations had. And I think that speaks to a segmentation of those two societies in ways that I think is going to be very hard for the CCP, the Chinese Communist Party, rule in China to ever accept. So while the political relationship is very good, I think at the grassroots level, despite very positive economic relationships between those two, you've got this emerging nationalist separation between the two. And that worries me in the long term. I don't think in the short term we're likely to have, especially with Ma Ying-jeou's reelection, any crises in the same way that we did in the early 2000s under Chen Shui-bian. But I think if you look forward 15 or 20 years, those trend lines on national identity in Taiwan suggest that both parties in Taiwan are going to have to increasingly appeal to the more independent side. And then the U.S. gets pulled along. Taiwan, a former ally, a market-based democracy, is very hard for us to abandon without sending deeply negative signals to our allies in the region. So I'm a little bit less worried about proximate crises, but I am worried about the long-term relationship there.
You mentioned about the aircraft carrier being, something of the language that the U.S. can more understand, what it might mean. But given also that it's an old USSR Hulk that they're rebuilding, what's their reasoning for doing that? Is there a strategic value for them to do if we know what it means, or is it more just a photo op?
We have so little insight into that sort of decision-making on the Chinese side, and it's very difficult to get the military to engage on those sorts of issues that I think we have to speculate. But there are a couple of areas that I intend to be drawn to. One, China joins the ranks of many other mid-sized and great powers like Britain, France, India, Thailand, who field carriers, and I think that accords them a sense of, we have arrived and rightful prestige that is at least an element. I don't think it's the most important element. While it's fairly straightforward for our naval forces to kind of conceptualize how they might deal with this in a crisis, that's not the case for regional players, for Taiwan by itself, or for Southeast Asian countries in particular. And so I think if you were a Chinese strategist thinking about how you wanted to project power into the southern portion of the South China Sea, where the Spratly Islands, which really don't have enough ground to serve as legitimate power projection bases themselves, there's one airstrip in all the Spratly Islands, then a carrier provides you some capabilities there. And I think that's why When you hear American officials, American military leaders speak about the carrier, they do speak in fairly calm terms. But when you talk to regional players, they have a somewhat more concerned attitude. It'll be a while before that carrier is a operational military asset. They don't have the planes yet. They have yet to practice, then therefore landing on a carrier at sea. These are operations that it took the U.S. a long time to perfect in a very intense crisis during World War II and an extended period of massive investment. The Chinese aren't pushing that hard. I mean, this has been a very slow developing carrier. Those of us who watched it when it was first sold to be a gambling casino, will remember how long this has been gestating in the Chinese system. And this is not a rushed to production. There will certainly be more carriers, too. And I think once you start talking about large numbers of carriers, then you'd have to reassess that. But in the next 10 or 15 years, that's not what's on the table.
Professor Tomy, question. You mentioned between the two armed forces that there exists a difference, not just in English and the Chinese language, but in doctrinal language. So that reminded me of some of the recent issues. On one hand, their Navy is developing a carrier, even though based on an old Hawk. But about a couple of years ago, when the Somalia, the pirates were hijacking the tankers or freeliners left and right, I remember one of the Chinese freighter was hijacked. Mm-hmm. And their naval task force, ostensibly part of the peacekeeping forces, were actually in the vicinity. And they completely have the ability to intercept the pirates. But unlike, the U.S. naval SEALs and shot the pirates to death, but the three, one destroyer, frigates, pretty much sort of like as though deliberately tried to avoid the rescue operation, ended up they paid I don't know how many million dollars to get the ship ransomed back or something. I wonder if you can maybe just make people think, whether their naval forces are truly combat ready or sort of like just for the show,
I think it's a very hard operation to take a few helicopters worth of special operations troops and then land them on another ship on the high seas. This is something that's difficult for our forces to do, and this is the first time the Chinese have engaged in that. The Chinese have had a lot of trouble in much simpler missions, and I think one of the real turning points for them was recognizing that in humanitarian relief missions at home, the paratroopers were unable to reach the mountain areas after the Sichuan earthquake in the first couple of days. And that's a core mission to how the PLA, the People's Liberation Army, connects to the society and ingrains itself in Chinese nationalism. So I think in terms of the Chinese participation in the anti-piracy patrols, it is exactly that sort of example that suggests there is value in them participating there. Because over time, they will learn the best practices for engaging in anti-piracy, which is certainly to have a quick response prior to the boarding of the ship. And in order to do that, you need to trust the signals that you're getting from other members of the international coalition, whether they're NATO, EU, or the United States, which means you need to integrate a little bit more into the task force than the Chinese have done to date. That you need to share some best practices, which means you're going to have to open up your military training a little bit to show the other side how you do it, because everybody demands reciprocity for these sorts of things. And so I think there is the potential for exactly that sort of convergence in a positive way that might be useful for reducing some of the large amount of difference of views. But also, think about what you're talking about. You're talking about changing the way China conceptualizes the role of its military and doing so in a way to emphasize its contribution not to disaster relief at home, which is an unambiguously positive mission, but to providing for the common good in a global commons, in a global thoroughfare, near the Middle East. And I think it is exactly that sort of outcome that one hopes is going on. And everything that I hear is that they're more and more becoming involved, that there are increasing number of coordinations and ship-to-ship visits while they remain outside of the coalition. So, I mean, I think upon their arrival, there was a real sense that they were far away from the norms, but there seems to be some evolution in a positive direction.
You mentioned about the values. That raised another concern, because the compared to the PLA versus, like, Western nations' armed forces, the PLA very much sort of behaved like they are an army serving the party, so to speak. Yeah. And oftentimes, especially with the recent upheaval within the Chinese upper echelon, you know, due to the high-ranking official who was trying to defect to the U.S. consulate, and there are probably ask any realtors in the Bay Area and everything. A lot of corrupt officials are buying properties here, and probably among some of them are high-ranking military officials. So that raised the question, like, during Qing Dynasty, you know, the entire Qing Navy was wiped out by the Japanese, even though they actually, from the equipment level point of view, they're not bad. I mean, they purchased a lot of German and the UK battleships.
Right.
Do you see there's any kind of, you know, connection, maybe, like,
well,
the history is repeating itself?
I think history always repeats itself in China, because China has so much history that you have a deep tapestry from which to draw your threads. I think in two ways there are, you know, important issues that are resonant here. One is the way that China is importing its military technology now is similar. It's drawing on a lot of different international sources. And the real challenge that poses for China is in integrating those capabilities. If you look at a modern Chinese destroyer, which are fairly capable, and I think this is an area that I worry more about than the Shulong, the so-called carrier, the integration of a fire control radar, the sighting radar, a missile, and the command and control to integrate all that with different systems. That's hard to do in the U.S. system, where we've got contractors who are used to working together. When you're buying one from the French, one from the Russians, one from the engines from the Ukrainians, you know, this causes real problems for the Chinese. So I'm not sure that you're going to have the same sorts of problems with international technology, but I think they are having some difficulties with international technology. The other thing I would just say about the commercialization of the military, corruption is certainly a huge problem, and that's a whole other lecture on China. But I think the military is somewhat less tainted by that than the rest of Chinese society, and that's a very low bar to set. But the decommercialization of 1998, by all measures, was a huge success. And everybody in my line of work, all the professors who look at China, who made predictions about whether this was going to be the footnote that shows there is no civilian control of the military, because the military is never going to give up all the money in those sidelines of, you know, producing white goods and running hotels, were proven wrong. And we all walked away with egg on our face for 10 years. So I think there is much less obsession with the financial side among the professional cadre of officers who I and my students and people in the Pentagon interact with, who take their jobs very seriously as military officers. Now, it's a big military, and there's plenty of room at the margins of that for enough corruption officials there and elsewhere, I'm sure.
I've heard people expressing fears about the Chinese military buildup, and I'm not sure I understand what they're all about, but they seem to worry about an episode of conquest, perhaps taking this military and their great power, economic and military power, and sort of using it the way the Soviets did after the Second World War. But I haven't seen any strong evidence of this, certainly in the history. So I was wondering if you could speak to some of those fears.
this is the chart of Chinese military spending that the Pentagon publishes on an annual basis. It's grown by about 15% per year for the last 20 years, or at least the last 15 years. That's a very substantial amount of growth and has allowed them to develop military capabilities far in excess of what they had prior. That said, it pales by comparison to the United States. And I think one of the things to remember is we live in a fairly defense-dominant world, or China finds itself in a defense-dominant geography. Here's, you know, the same sort of chart that we presented earlier with a map of concentric circles showing the ranges of Chinese missiles that they might be able to hold at risk American carriers using the DF-21 variant that they have or are about to have, or maybe a air-launched missile as well. Okay, fair enough. This causes us big problems when we think about Taiwan scenarios. Absolutely true. However, that's not the same as conquering. Right, being able to rein in missiles on Taiwan or on Japanese naval targets or on American naval targets isn't the end of the battle. That's the beginning of the battle. Then what? In Taiwan, you can make an argument that they might have coercive options thereafter. I think in particular, it depends on what Taiwan does over the next 10 years in terms of their own military capabilities. But beyond that, China starts to have real problems in being able to project aircraft into an area to be able to dominate the airs so that very vulnerable naval assets could follow up and then conquer. China lives in a funny neighborhood. It's got the Himalayas and the Tibetan Plateau on one side, making it very hard for either India or China to threaten the national survival of the other. On the other hand, the rest of its coastline, you know, Russia is a separate case, the rest of its neighbors, that we are most closely tied to, are coastal states, and water is a great defensive asset. And so China's got to project force across that. That's very hard to do. Taiwan's very close, and so I think it's its own case, and we could spend hours talking about that. I think the situation is dire but not hopeless. But the rest of the region, I think, has a much more greater degree of security. China doesn't have a lot of amphibious lift. That's very hard to do. We got deterred from doing that against Saddam Hussein in 1991 at the sort of peak of our Cold War military power from engaging in amphibious operations. Instead went in on land. That's just a very challenging prospect for a very backward military that doesn't have a lot of experience in doing that. So I don't see a lot of potential for conquest. Now, if you're talking about coercive measures where you're reining in scores, hundreds of missiles on a variety of different targets, that's a different case. And submarine warfare that would raise the cost of shipping and cause a lot of damage to economies and certainly plenty of death and destruction. Again, that's a separate issue. But it's very hard to coerce somebody into surrender in those terms.
I'd like to ask a few contextual historical questions and bring it to now from a feminist perspective, because just in my lifetime, going to China in 71 to see family and relatives, the experience of my generation during the Vietnam War, which followed the Korean War, is that our generation actually has been branded with that, red China, communist China. When my mother and, everybody was sending money back to their relatives, that became illegal. The FBI issued something in 1953. So from China's point of view, from the Western colonization of a lot of the world, and then China's Civil War and the Korean War. MacArthur left the Philippines for occupied Japan. He was the only one that would point his finger at Incheon and say, we're going to land here. So actually, the history that put China's revolution in a defensive posture since 49, as is divided Korea right now. Mm. So if you try to picture that, those of us as mothers and grandmothers who raise children, girls and boys, we can see the development. I had my grandson in Target. I never saw so many war gun toys. Nerf has a whole line of new rocket blasters, okay? So if you're in Asia and you live through those periods, okay, China experienced war on land, Korea, Japan was firebombed, the U.S.-Philippines war. I remember hearing one that the U.S. Military intelligence missed. Well, during the difficult year of 2010, right, I do believe the Chinese government raised the question, the U.S. has as its sphere of influence the Caribbean, right? So why shouldn't China have legitimate rights to a regional sphere of influence?
Well, and I think it is important to remember that historic context. And I think when you look in the 1960s, China had found itself and put itself to some extent in a position where it had alienated both of the superpowers and was under threat from both. Right? It's not just the secondary wars, but it was very concerned in 69 about the war with the Soviets expanding to a major Chinese-Soviet Union war. And so I do understand Chinese threat perceptions and their origins in the Qing Dynasty and the way that the Qing Dynasty collapsed and Western society's complicity in that. China today is in a very different geostrategic position. China has not been more secure, any time since the height of the Qing Dynasty than it is today. It has a secure nuclear arsenal that allows it to deter any nuclear adversary. No country threatens the core of Chinese territorial interests, with the exception of Taiwan issue. Tibet and Xinjiang are not contested internationally, although there are human rights concerns and movements that raise them. Those aren't national government perspectives, and therefore they don't have the same capability behind them. In terms of spheres of interest, I think there are countries within the East Asian and region that would not welcome a Chinese role as a protector of a sphere of influence. And I think that's exactly what you've seen. If you wanted to turn around the discussion of the provocations in 2010 that one could point to China on, but I tried to point out a broader regional context, some of the reaction to that within the region has been a desire to draw the United States in, and exactly in the Philippines, in Vietnam, in Indonesia, in Australia, and certainly in our two treaty allies in Northeast Asia, Japan and South Korea, have really looked to solidify their relationship with the United States. And so there's not an acceptance of that sphere within the region. I think that they have a voice too, right, and should. I think we're in a different geopolitical era than we were when the Monroe Doctrine was declared. You don't benefit from control of territory economically in the way that you did. At the end of the day, the most productive assets are those, just down the road here, the financial hubs and the innovative hubs that are human capital-based, not resource-based, and that's much harder to conquer. So I think that puts us in a much more relaxed situation. It doesn't mean that nationalist or other concerns don't necessarily impede that development.
Great. Well, I'm going to take the last question. And so you teach at the Naval Postgraduate School, and many of these your students are military officers, active duty.
Correct.
And assuming that they are going to be future leaders of the military, since they're investing a couple years of education. So when you speak to these gentlemen and ladies, what's the issue that you want to communicate that maybe they've lacked in the general perception, the media, the 10-foot-tall the PLA soldier and the carriers that aren't quite up to speed yet. What's the message that they don't get that you try to give them?
Well, I think there's a real tendency whenever we look at other actors to treat them as monolithic. Right, there was monolithic communism in the Cold War, and today we kind of look at China and think about China doing this, China acting as such. And we would never do that for American foreign policy. When we think about American foreign policy, we know, well, Congress is pushing this, and the Pentagon's pushing this, and State Department's checking them. But look, the National Security Council is very strong in this administration, so they're able to adjudicate and not in a previous administration. And the commercial actors are preventing any sanctions from being imposed and so on. Well, the same thing happens in China. It's just in a much more opaque fashion. But that said, you can still peel back some of the layers of that onion to try to understand who the different voices are. One of the things that we know very clearly about China today that's distinct from 20 years ago is the voices around the table on foreign policy decisions are much more diverse today than they were 20 years ago, that you have increased opportunities for civilian actors, for people outside of the government in the commercial sector, for provincial-level officials to play roles. And so to try to think about the policy outcome that you see as a product of a process in China where you've got diverse voices pushing in different ways, maybe none of which wanted the outcome that was the resulting policy outcome. But I think that helps us to avoid kind of worst-casing things that are coming out of their side when it may have just been that's how the sausage gets made.
That's good. You'd recommend then Robert Putnam and Graham Allison for reading.
Absolutely. Very Assign good. It to them in Intro to IR.
Excellent. Great. Well, I want to thank you, Dr. Professor Twomey, for speaking to us today. And I also want to thank our co-sponsoring organizations, the Asia Society of Northern California, which has a great series of programs you should check out, and the Truman National Security Project. Thank you very much.
Thank you all.